Hello, hello everyone. Welcome. Come on in. I'm glad you have found your way here to Tea and Gemstones, your home for all of the history, science, and social commentary of anything and everything to do with gemstones, jewelry, and precious metals. As always, I am your writer, researcher, and host, Jen, a lifelong sparkle enthusiast obsessed with all the small details of everything, because guys, that's where a lot of the joy is. Welcome to the premiere episode of whatever season 3 turns out to be. I have had some health issues I've been dealing with, and I appreciate everyone's patience and kind messages during this time. I'm glad that I'm able to create some content for y'all. So for the premieres of the first and second seasons, I took a very deep dive into the world of diamond colors, the full rainbow, and beyond. Now, beginning season 3, I want this episode to shine a well-justified light on a set of gemstones that are unfairly considered less than, while also being praised for their ability to copy diamonds. We are taking a look at a group of gemstones who for too long have been used as imitators and not acknowledged for how great they are, just for who they are, not what they can pretend to be. So let's get started. Let me introduce you to the imitators. When talking about, thinking about, shopping for, really anything to do with gemstones, most people's first initial thought is diamonds. Diamonds are a girl's best friend, a diamond is forever, we're supposed to shine bright like a diamond, and I would submit that there is no more universal status symbol for wealth and being a big deal than a great big sparkly diamond. And the world is sort of all on board with the diamond love. According to a market analysis report put together by Grand View Research, the global diamond market size was valued at $89.1 billion in 2019. That's a lot of diamonds being bought and sold. But y'all, diamonds are not cheap and easily accessible. Let's remove colored diamonds, diamonds that, due to additional elements mixed into the diamond pure carbon structure, are imbued with coveted hues of green, blue, pink, etc. Let's not have colored diamonds be included in the price value discussion, because colored diamonds are so universally expensive, they're hands down the most expensive gemstones. So for this cost discussion, we're talking about reasonably white-ish diamonds on the color scale with a normal acceptable range of clarity. And that price point, for example, for a 1-carat diamond can range from $2,000 up to $25,000, depending on the stone's 4 C's, the letter C, which stands for cut, color, clarity, and yeah, carat size. Even at $2,000, that's a chunk of change. That's some significant money to shell out, since according to the U.S. Census Bureau in 2021, the average median American household income was about $70,000. Doing the math, that's, say, the low-range quality 1-carat diamond is still 2.8% of an entire American's household income for the entire year. Yes, diamonds are a luxury, and you don't have to watch TV for very long before some kind of diamond jewelry marketing ad is put before your eyes. But it's an unshakable fact that diamonds are economically a treat, and flat out not attainable to a lot of people, because people don't just want one diamond in a ring and there, boom, all done. No, owning diamonds is addicting. You're gonna want a diamond band to complement that ring, and maybe a tennis bracelet. And diamond stud earrings are a classic staple piece everyone should have, yeah? And can we just please lean into the sparkle and go for a diamond necklace? Ah, yes. How lovely. And wait, my bill is how much? Okay, so how do people, men and women alike, men definitely sport some diamonds too, let's not discriminate. How do people achieve their desired white, sparkly diamond status symbols without breaking their credit card limit? They turn to the imitators. As long as there have been luxury items, there have been knockoffs, copycats, and fakes. I bet in the caveman days, someone found some kind of rock that looked kind of like a coveted saber-toothed tiger teeth and strung it up on a necklace and wore it to the fire pit meeting to look awesome without actually risking their life wrestling a big cat. That's my imagined scenario. Now I've said it. I'm pretty sure humans and saber-toothed cats never lived at the same time, but you get my point. People have been faking it to make it forever. And there is enormous desire to fake diamonds. Diamonds are the ultimate status symbol. And there are several gemstones, both synthetic and natural, that have had almost their entire identity become the fact that they can imitate diamonds. The king of the imitators is a super sparkly, super clear and white, super affordable and cheap stone that I promise you've seen many, many times. Cubic zirconia. Cubic zirconia, not to be confused with the gemstone zircon, cubic zirconia is the cubic crystalline form of zirconium dioxide. Zirconium dioxide does exist in the natural world, a version of it, a mineral named badylite, was discovered in 1892, but it is super rare and honestly not that aesthetically attractive. Badylite is a waxy yellow color, but diamonds have been the most popular gemstone for hundreds of years. Scientists had big economic motivations to find a way to create a lab-made diamond imitator. And the French in the 1960s had some promising developments in the quest. They developed a system of molten zirconia being contained within an egg-like shell of solid zirconia that used water cooling to trigger crystal growth. I am envisioning some kind of majestic tiny crystal chicken being born. The French method was called cold crucible. And while, yes, it worked, the end results were really small, not that economically viable, which really is the entire point of the effort. In the early 1970s, the Soviets got involved. And you know how the Soviets are usually the bad guys in spy novels, James Bond movies, etc., and they always seem to have like dark, scary uniforms, evil lairs, you know, very stereotypically evil when they're depicted in the media. Well, sometimes I think those dark stereotypes aren't unfounded because the Soviet scientists named their process for creating cubic zirconia skull crucible. Yeah, skull crucible. It doesn't sound very academic. It sounds like something belonging in a Marvel movie, but nevertheless, that's what their process was named. Some people say it was because the crystal growth container kind of looked like a skull, or that the crystals would sometimes grow in a human skull-esque shape. Whatever the reason, it's as if the Soviets let a moody 15-year-old emo kid name the process. But get this. The Soviets' skull crucible method worked, and worked well, but they weren't even after the cubic zirconia to make jewelry. The Russians were dealing with a shortage of gemstones to use in their laser beams, and that's why they were after a created gemstone with ideal optical qualities. For laser beams. The skull crucible to make laser beams. definitely sounds like something from a movie. But anyway, the Soviets, they were able to produce large, high-quality crystals. Their discovery was officially published in 1973, and commercial production of large-scale amounts of cubic zirconia kicked off in 1976. And still today, some people call the process the skull melt method. I had some difficulty finding modern numbers for production levels or sales figures for cubic zirconia. I did find a fascinating article from the Gemological Institute of America written in 1981 titled Cubic Zirconia, An Update. And the GIA states that in just 4 years, production of cubic zirconia had reached an estimated 13 tons. And it's safe to say it's currently a lot more because cubic zirconia is gorgeous and internally flawless, checking in at a sturdy 8 to 8.5 on the Mohs hardness scale, compared to diamonds top of the pyramid 10. And cubic zirconia also has the very appealing high refractive index. The fancy science definition of refractive index is, in optics, the refractive index of an optical medium is a dimensionless number that gives the indication of the light bending ability of that medium. Or you could just say refractive index is kind of like how good is sparkles. And cubic zirconia's refractive index is considered high, scoring 2.15 to 2.18 compared to the 2.42 of diamonds. So cubic zirconia's stats are well on par to be a dupable match for diamonds. Because here's the real kicker. Remember how I talked about a 1-carat diamond being in the low price range of $2,000? Well, an internally flawless, very sparkly, pure white cubic zirconia clocking in at 1 carat can register for the price of about $20. You heard me correctly. $20. 1% of what a diamond would cost. That is undeniably much, much, much easier for the average consumer to take on purchasing. Some naysayers point to the differing Mohs scale points of the two stones as the real deciding factor. And yes, diamonds are a rock solid, pardon the pun, 10 on the Mohs scale, higher than any other naturally occurring substance on Earth. And yeah, cubic zirconia is lower at an 8.5. But 8.5 is harder than topaz, which clocks in at an 8. Amethyst and emerald are a 7. And moonstones, opals, and turquoise all hover around between 5 and 6. So yes, cubic zirconia is softer than a diamond, but also so is every other gemstone. And cubic zirconia is harder than a heck of a lot of other gemstones. And for the affordable price point, if your stone gets scratched or damaged, it doesn't break the budget to replace the stone when it costs less than $50 for a new sparkly cubic zirconia. Yes, people will be snobs about cubic zirconia, and I understand that. There are many grades of high-quality cubic zirconia, all the way to the cheap stuff that's twinkling feebly at you from Old Navy or for the Forever 21 checkout aisle. But I cannot in good consciousness look down at a gemstone that enables so many people to have the beautiful sparkly look that our society has made the norm for a well-established aesthetic jewelry look. Cubic zirconia allows you to try rings with different styles. Having a travel ring for trips that you won't be afraid of accidentally leaving in a hotel room, or just treating yourself to something pretty to make you feel good at a time when national inflation is at record levels. Has anyone else noticed how expensive, everything is right now? Why does every single day cost at least $200? If you want to have a little something glittery as a Christmas present or to celebrate a milestone or just because groceries cost $10 million, a diamond might not very well be in the cards because Cheerios cost $7 a box and the average American household spends 16% of their entire monthly budget on gasoline. Sure. In some very wealthy world, all that sparkles would be diamonds. But over here, in my real world, that's not always possible. And we shouldn't turn up our noses or our backs to some great options for sparkly happiness. And cubic zirconia, while overwhelmingly the most popular and abundant option, isn't the only imitator out there. We've got rock crystal. Did you know there was a gemstone called rock crystal? The name crystal comes from the Greek word for ice because it was believed this clear gemstone was forever frozen. Now that seems like something out of a Disney movie. Rock crystal is a transparent variety of the silica mineral quartz, and rock crystal used to be super popular for carving and decorative gemstones because it was found in large quantities all over the world. However, economics were not on rock crystal's side, and it was replaced in jewelry by more cost-effective substitutes like glass and plastic, which is so unfair because rock crystal can be truly stunning. The colorless quartz takes center stage in Herkimer County, New York, a county that in the 2020 census had a little over 60,000 residents. Herkimer, if that name is making you tilt your head a little to the side and say, wait, do I know? Yes. You've probably heard the term Herkimer diamond, a reference to the remarkably clear, doubly terminated quartz rock crystal mined in the county. A geological phenomenon resulting from 500 million years ago, the county being under a shallow sea, receiving sediment runoff from the Adirondack Mountains. Fertile feeding ground to grow gorgeous rock crystal. Rock crystal is still used in jewelry today. It has an affordable price point and clear sparkly gemstones are obviously very popular. But rock crystal also features heavily in antique and vintage jewelry. There are especially some gorgeous Art Deco era pieces with rock crystal as their star, nestled and glittering among filigree work, so strung up in large, lovely chunks as the ultimate glam beaded necklace, rock crystal, being the clear, colorless member of the quartz family, has a Mohs scale rating of 7. This gives it decent scratch resistance, but it's a long way from diamonds 10. Some people get really hung up on the Mohs scale, treating it as the pinnacle ruler to measure gemstone suitability. And then, counterpoint, side rant, if I may be indulged for a brief moment, there are some people who pay zero mind to referencing the Mohs scale and put opals in engagement rings and whatnot. So let's just agree to strive for a middle ground of reverence for the Mohs scale, yeah? But let's just say the Mohs scale does really matter to you. Diamonds are a stretch on the bank account, but you don't want to compromise with a softer gemstone. What to do? Well, there are two imitators that reach high up into the Mohs scale, but I consider it a shame if these two gemstones have to live forever marked as merely diamond imitators. They deserve recognition for their true identities. The next two stones are white sapphire and moissanite. Let's talk about white sapphire first because I'm going to make the assumption that you, the listener, are a little bit more familiar with white sapphire. Sapphire is the gemstone variety of the mineral corundum, and it clocks in at a very strong 9 on the Mohs scale, perfect for everyday wear, and it can stand up to the heavy-duty lifestyle of being a gemstone in a daily ring. Sapphires come in every color of the rainbow, including the fun party trick of being color change or featuring a star shape inside when the light catches just right. Sapphire picks up its different colors, like the very popular dark blue or happy pink or sunny yellow, from whatever extra impurity gets added to the corundum during the gemstone formation process. For example, the added elements responsible for the royal cornflower blue, like Kate Middleton and Princess Diana's engagement ring features, that's, you can thank iron and titanium for making that beautiful blue color, and an element called chromium. When it's included, it produces bright pink. But when there are no added extras, when the corundum is left purely pure, then the sapphire is white. Which you might be thinking, oh, slam dunk then, yeah, for imitating a diamond. The stone is white, and it's hard enough to exist in that oh-so-important status symbol of an engagement ring. White sapphires can even be pretty easily grown in a lab, so the price per carat is in the hundreds, not the thousands. Although, very high-quality stones will raise the value, the number still stays well below diamond rates. But white sapphires are not the perfect imitator of diamonds, a title that I'm still saying goes firmly to cubic zirconia in terms of aesthetic looks. See, white sapphires have what can be described as a softness to them. Diamonds are very dynamic. That sparkle, that shine, the flashes of light a diamond can throw from all the way across the room. White sapphires, that's just not the game they play. When it comes to ratings of brilliance, dispersion, and scintillation, aka brightness, flashes of light, sparkles of light, diamonds outscore white sapphires by a large margin. White sapphires frequently have a softly milky or cloudy appearance. I've heard it described less fondly as they look waxy. I don't like the term waxy. It makes me feel like the stone is dirty. I don't know why the adjective milky doesn't bother me though. Maybe it sounds more romantic. To each their own. And that's how white sapphires are. They are their own style and vibe. Because of their high Mohs number, I've seen many people leap onto white sapphires as the foolproof way to dance around the cost of a diamond. But a white sapphire will not give you the same look as a diamond, all flash and grabbing attention. But because of the high demand for white sapphires as a substitute or imitator stone, their price point, while yes, more affordable, is nowhere near the cost savings of a cubic zirconia, which will sparkle a lot more like a diamond. I believe people should stop trying to shove white sapphires into the like a diamond box, because it's such a romantic and lovely stone all on its own. I'd like to see people flaunting and proud of their center stone, actually telling people their gemstone is a white sapphire, instead of trying to pass as a diamond, when all people are going to think is like, wow, huh, their diamond must be dirty, it sure doesn't sparkle, and then moving on. So white sapphire checks the box of being high on the Mohs scale, its 9 being higher than cubic zirconia's 8.5, but it doesn't have the sparkle and aesthetics to truly be diamond's slightly more affordable twin. Well, let me bring to your attention a gemstone that too few people know about, because it's awesome. Moissanite. On paper, moissanite is a naturally occurring silicon carbide. It was first discovered by a French chemist named Henri Moissan. See, when you discover a new gemstone, you usually get to pick the name, and I guess Henry thought his last name was just the ticket. I guess Moissanite rolls off the tongue easier than, like, Henryite. But guess where Henry discovered his new gemstone? It was inside a rock sample from a meteor crater located in Canyon Diablo in Arizona in the United States. Yeah, a moissanite came from space. He found the crystals in 1893 and at first thought they were diamonds. Already sounds promising as a diamond imitator, yeah? And it wasn't until 1904, 11 years later, that he actually realized the stone was a unique mineral form of silicon carbide. But how about this for thunder stealing? 2 years before Henri Moissan's discovery, artificial silicon carbide had been synthesized in a lab by an American chemist named Edward G. Ashian. So Natural moissanite is really, really rare. It is not economical at all to have natural moissanite in jewelry. In fact, I've never even seen a real life example. If you have, send it to me. I want to see it. But as for growing in a lab, moissanite is excellent. It first splashed on the mainstream jewelry market in 1998, not that long ago at all, when a company called Charles & Colvard, based in North Carolina, got approved government patents to create and market their lab-grown gemstones of silicon carbide. As of 2018, all of the Charles & Colvard patents have expired, and moissanite is currently experiencing a surge of popularity as more is made all over the world. But why is moissanite so appealing? Well, it has a unique Mohs scale number of 9.25, making it over sapphire, rock crystal, cubic zirconia, indeed just under diamond. There are machines called diamond testers. Sometimes they look like a calculator with a pointy tip or a souped-up vape pen, and you touch the metal tip to a gemstone, and it will tell you if a gemstone is a diamond or not. And moissanite are mischievously notorious for being a gemstone that can fool a diamond tester machine into saying, "I'm a diamond." How's that for being an imitator? The reason moissanite can pull off this masquerade is because of thermal conductivity. Moissanite and diamonds conduct heat very similarly, allowing for the machine to get confused. But, I mean, we're not going around testing everyone's stones with a machine. I guess, unless you're at a cocktail party and need an icebreaker, but that seems dangerous, maybe not. I'd say 99% of the time, we're looking at gemstones with just our regular eyeballs our mamas gave us. So how do moissanite and diamond compare visually? Well, here's where moissanite steps out of the perimeters of just imitating diamonds and becomes its own wonderful kind of gemstone. There is a measurable gemstone feature called the refractive index. I mentioned it while discussing cubic zirconia. Refractive index is how much a gem sparkles. And let me tell y'all, moissanite can really throw down some sparkle. Moissanite's refractive index scores between 2.65 to 2.69. Diamond scores a 2.42. And you could be forgiven for thinking those numbers are really close. How big a difference can it really be? But guys, no other gemstone scores as high as moissanite. Rubies are a refractive index of 1.76. Emeralds are a 1.56. Here's the crux of it all. Moissanite, by the numbers, is the world's most brilliant gemstone. But this effect, sometimes referenced as disco ball or fireworks, this gives moissanite away. This is the thing that duly prevents moissanite from being the perfect diamond dupe, but also allows moissanite to literally outshine the competition as its own damn self. You see a moissanite sparkling in the sun, and it's absolutely gorgeous, but as you look at it, you will know it's not a diamond. Diamonds throw white flashes of light, but because moissanite has a different faceting pattern, moissanite throws flashes of rainbow light, glimpses of green, red, yellow, etc. Whatever is going on with the fireworks of light gemstones, it is the opposite of boring. And not that I'm calling diamonds boring, there's nothing quite like the look of a diamond. And that's where the imitators just can't perfectly capture and grasp the hold of the vibe. A diamond, it can't be held 100% in replica by a different gemstone. But boy howdy, people try. Other clear gemstones people use in place of a diamond include precious beryl, white topaz, white zircon, fabulite, linobite, and strass. Strass is a fancy word for rhinestones made of glass. I appreciate the resourcefulness. I also want people to be happy. If someone wants a white, colorless, sparkly gemstone in their jewelry, I want them to be able to have that aesthetic without going into debt over it. And maybe this is my little soapbox of an opinion and people will really disagree with me over it, but we need to stop trying to find the perfect imitator. Not because it's not a worthwhile endeavor, but because it's already been achieved. Cubic zirconia. Let me repeat it for the people in the back. Cubic zirconia. When you get a high quality stone, it looks beautiful. Its durability is certainly strong enough for daily wear, and its amazingly affordable price point cannot be beaten. Don't agonize over what to do if you feel a diamond is out of reach. Many, many jewelry designers and stores offer rings and jewelry done in precious metals, 14 karat, 18 karat gold, and even platinum that feature cubic zirconia stones because they are worthy. It's okay. Please don't turn your nose up at cubic zirconia. It has a job to do, and it does its job really well. As for the other imitator gemstones, my hope is that after this episode, you have some appreciation and knowledge about these stones to value and care about them outside of their differing levels of ability to copy a diamond's look. It's one of my goals with this podcast to bring gemstones with low name recognition to the forefront and share them with the world so they can be loved for their own unique qualities and abilities. I had fun doing that today, so I hope you enjoyed yourself too. That's all for this episode of Tea and Gemstones. Do you have a piece of jewelry that features one of the above-mentioned imitator gemstones? If so, please tell me about it. What's the story? Are you leaning into the diamond look, or did you pick your gemstone choice for another reason? I want to hear about it. Leave me a comment on the Instagram grid post for this episode. I would love to connect on social media. You can find me at Tea and Gemstones Podcast. If you're loving these regular season episodes and you're all caught up and you want more, Tea and Gemstones also has a Patreon. There's a link in the show notes. On Patreon, there is an exclusive library of episodes found nowhere else, and you can also get fun show merchandise like stickers, t-shirts, and tote bags. Can never have enough stickers and tote bags. Thanks to everyone leaving ratings and reviews, especially if you're listening on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. That really helps the show stay active in the algorithm so new listeners can find the podcast. It has been a pleasure spending time with y'all. I am really looking forward to whatever season 3 ends up being. I have been your host, Jen. Our theme song is by Joseph McDade. We may have had some additional music work by Audionautics. And I'm excited for everything that we're going to be doing moving forward. Until next time, everyone, stay sparkly.